On last week's Underreported, we heard about Iraq's devastated healthcare system. There are not enough medicines to go around, the hospitals are in terrible shape, and some patients have even been murdered in their beds. As a follow-up this week, we decided to look into what's being done to help the people who can't get care in Baghdad's hospitals. With me now is Nicholas Di Torrente, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders. He's just returned from a trip to Jordan and northern Iraq, where his organization is trying to relieve the problem somewhat. And I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi.
Hello.
What kinds of programs do you currently have set up in Jordan?
Well, I think the show last week really highlighted the problems that the Iraqi healthcare system is facing in terms of coping with the absolute huge numbers of casualties that are occurring every day in Iraq, throughout Iraq. We see the headlines, we see a car bomb, we see 20 deaths, but we kind of forget that behind the 20 deaths, or along with the 20 deaths, you have often dozens of people who are injured, and often very severely so. And they're brought to hospitals in Iraq that are really overwhelmed and are unable to cope for many reasons, including the flight of medical staff. About half of Iraq's doctors are thought to have left the country and fled to escape the general insecurity, also targeting of medical professionals. So they receive very inadequate care, these patients, and they are often just patched up and sent home. And that's the real difficulty for us is, and for people who want to help, is that in order to help people and provide life-saving care, you have to be where the violence is occurring. But it's precisely where the violence is occurring that it's the most unsafe for aid organizations to be, aid professionals to be, medical professionals, and for the patients. And we do not have an international presence inside of the southern and central parts of Iraq to be able to provide that hands-on care.
So you're in northern Iraq, the Kurdish area, which is relatively stable, and you are in Jordan, I'm assuming mostly in Amman. But how do people, somebody's in Baghdad or another area where there are serious dangers, is wounded, doesn't wind up going to an American hospital, which is often the case, and then they wind up in these terrible Iraqi hospitals. But can they just get in a car and go to one of your facilities in Amman?
No, for Amman, the facility there really provides reconstructive surgery for patients who have been stabilized, who have received some kind of care, and who need reconstructive surgery, orthopedic surgery. Their legs have been shattered, blown up, and they've had poor care, so they've had non-unions. Their bones are still broken. They need reconstructive surgery, maxillofacial surgery. We have a number of cases of people whose face has been really severely damaged, loss of eyes, loss of the lower jaw, inability to eat, and these are the cases that we're taking care of, and plastic surgery cases as well. People who've been burnt, whose hands have been burnt, they can't open their hands, don't have mobility. So these are the kinds of patients that we identify throughout Iraq with a network of Iraqi doctors, and then we bring to Jordan and we fly them to Jordan with a care provider, and we provide this kind of high-tech surgery in Jordan. These are often multiple operations. People stay there for several months, and we get patients who, it's not life-saving surgery, it's reconstructive functional surgery for patients who have already received some form of treatment before.
Although I also assume that there are people who have serious infections because there's such a lack of medicine. They don't need passports to go from Iraq to Jordan, do they?
Well, you've touched on two of our biggest challenges with this program. The first one is the medical challenge. People receive such inadequate care, and the treatment is so haphazard inside Iraq that they often do come with very serious multi-drug-resistant infections, infected bones, infected soft tissue, and we have to provide antibiotherapy, very complicated, complex, difficult antibiotherapy before they can even be operated. So that is, from a medical point of view, that's one of our biggest challenges. About 50% of all our orthopedic cases come from come in to our facility with this kind of infection. And the second challenge is getting people to come to Jordan. And there they do need passports. They have to cross an international border, and they need to be vetted and by the Jordanian authorities from a security point of view, an immigration point of view. And we're having serious challenges in bringing patients in. The numbers are very, very low. We've only been able to bring in about 200 patients, and it's a very serious hassle to be allowed to bring these patients in.
Well, under Saddam Hussein, people living in a repressive country, I'm sure many people didn't have passports. And poor people generally don't have passports, but that doesn't mean that they're not going to be wounded in a car bombing.
Well, precisely, and it's a much larger problem because you have approximately 2 million Iraqis that have fled their country and that flee mainly to Syria and to Jordan. It used to be quite easy to cross the border, with passports, of course, but it's been increasingly difficult, especially into Jordan. The restrictions have heightened for ordinary Iraqis who want to leave the country, and the road is unsafe, so many of them fly, and it's very hard to get into the airport. And of course, there's also a big push at the Ministry of Interior to get passports to be allowed to leave. And you have this huge, number of people who are desperate to get out of Iraq and who are all jostling for passports. And you can imagine how difficult it is for ordinary people, poor people, especially people who are injured, as you say, to obtain that passport.
And I'm sure that the problems aren't only physical. People who've been through this kind of stress suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. Do you have to also provide them with mental health counseling?
Well, certainly they've all been traumatized. They have psychological issues in dealing with the incident itself and with the aftermath, the fact that they're, they have, for instance, they're partially disfigured, or they've lost a limb, and that's a very hard thing to cope with. What it was quite a strong sight for me to see was the fact that many of these patients spend many months in Amman, and they're in the hospital, but they're also in a hotel that we've set up where they wait for between operations, getting either preoperative or postoperative care. And there's a very strong feeling of mutual support among these patients who come from all over Iraq and who have come from all religious backgrounds, from all walks of life, and who find themselves in a similar predicament and who are really pulling together. And it was quite astounding to see. We always hear about these divisions, Shia, Sunni, Kurds, Arabs, and so on. And there they were all, without sounding too ideal, they were all really pulling together and supporting each other.
Well, what happens after they are healed? Do they have to go back to Iraq? In some cases, that might very well be a death sentence.
Well, they, as your previous guest, described, most people want to go back and live in where their home is. That's what they want to do. In this case, it's no different. Most people do return to Iraq. We only have a very small number of people who have remained in Jordan and who've sought for refugee status. That's actually the biggest worry of the Jordanian authorities. They are rationing the numbers of admissions that we can bring into Jordan because they want to see these people go back home and back into Iraq, which most of them actually do so.
What about the clinics in northern Iraq? That's obviously a lot easier logistically because you don't need a passport to get up there.
Well, precisely. We wanted to get closer to the violence. We wanted to be able to treat not only patients requiring orthopedic reconstructive care, but also patients who were requiring more immediate emergency trauma surgery. And so that is why we've set up and are supporting a number of trauma centers, burn units and trauma centers in northern Iraq. I was in...
Are they completely safe?
Well, the situation in northern Iraq for me was, quite surprisingly safe. I mean, it was very quiet. It's very stable for the moment. It's easy to move around. I walked in the town. I took taxis. I took the bus in Soleimaniye, which you have to pinch yourself and remind yourself that you're in Iraq. But in fact, it's it is quiet, and it does offer an environment where we can provide this kind of care. Hospitals have also maintained services in Iraqi Kurdistan, and many doctors from the rest of Iraq have gone there. So there are other services available, and they are getting referrals. When I was there, they were getting wounded patients coming from Diyala province, for instance, and from the recent big blast in Kirkuk, we received dozens of casualties in Sulaymaniyah. We received burned patients who were referred across this kind of line inside the country between the contested areas further south and the north that is under administration of the Kurdish regional government.
Well, every day we hear stories about car bombings and the like, and many people dying and many more being injured. I'm sure that the situation is dire. Probably even Doctors Without Borders are suffering a bit from shortages. Are there enough drugs there? Or are there enough people to take care of all of the sick and wounded?
Well, I think that the biggest concern is really for the frontline care providers who are still present in Baghdad, in the emergency rooms, in Mosul, in Kirkuk, and who are doing their jobs as best as they can. Lots of them have left, but many remain, and they're under tremendous pressure and tremendous strain with inadequate resources. They're under pressure from the political and militia groups around the hospitals. It's very dangerous for them, but they're the ones who are providing really the bulk of the care that is still available inside Iraq, and we have to find ways to do everything possible to support them. So we are sending them supplies, other organizations as well, and by providing this care outside in areas that are a bit safer, where we can be based, it's a bit of solidarity with them in trying to relieve them of some of the burden that they have in dealing with the many, many patients. And the numbers of casualties are really staggering. And that's also the other thing is we really tend to forget how many people are wounded in inside the country.
How do listeners who want to help contact you?
Well, our website at doctorswithoutborders.org has a lot of information, including about this program, and we have we featured profiles also of individual patients, and you can read their stories in their own words, and I think that's a very powerful experience just to hear a little bit what people are going through.
And we have a link to your website on our webpage at wnyc.org. Thank you so much for being with us, Nicholas DiTorrente, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders. Thank you for participating in this week's Underreported.
Thank you very much.